nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
What I'm going to do now is just get back into today's lecture and talk about GMP, which is a good manufacturing practice. And we're going to go through what that really means, because it turns out that these are standard things that are worldwide. There are worldwide definitions that are accepted, and no matter where you are in the world, you're going to have to satisfy certain good manufacturing practices, and you'll never put things into human beings if you don't have them GMP, good manufacturing practice approved. So we're going to go through a lot of that, what that means, and I realize that I'm not going to, you know, this is something that can be a really horribly dull topic area. So what I'm going to try to do is hit the major points. Why do we do what we do? And give you the whys rather than infinite details. I'm going to guide you to some of the documents. You can, in fact, I even guide you on small subsets of those documents. Say, look at these pages, you know, and you don't have to read. I'm not expecting you to read through those documents. Not unless you're, if you're having a sleepless night sometime and you need that to help you, you can read through the document in detail. So we're going to talk about this, and hopefully at this point when we talk about manufacturing these, and I think you'll see this in the coming up in a few slides here, you already should know from the course how hard it is to make standard reproducible nanomedical systems. They're complicated. There's a lot of things that go into how do you keep the size constant, how do you keep all the layers on, how do you keep so that you have the right zeta potential and you don't have agglomerated nanoparticles. There's just so many different things. And this is one of the things that is, I think, frankly, the pharmaceutical industry is a little bit terrified to get into this because they don't know quite what they're facing. It's got too many parts to it that they're not used to dealing with. On the other hand, that's exactly why I teach it, because I think that we have to at least start thinking about this, and we don't have to get it perfect. We just have to start figuring it out and get it good enough. And we have to start somewhere and start plunging into this problem. So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about bio-nano manufacturing, what that means, and how to test some of the quality control issues. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and get into a little bit more detail. So the main thing that we're trying to do today is discuss if we're going to make these make these in the laboratory. And I know there's maybe about a third of the class actually has been involved in making some kind of nanoparticle for something in this class, and the rest of you haven't yet, but or may not. But what I'd like to do is talk about some of the issues that you get when you try to make something reproducibly day to day. And then what the problems are in doing it at laboratory scale versus doing it in at a scale where you're actually gonna scale it up for large animals and humans. And scale up has things change a lot when you scale them up. So let's talk a little bit about that. So first, what does little c GMP mean? And what that means, the little c stands for current. And GMP is good manufacturing practice. And there's a reason why we do this, we frequently use the CGMP, and that is it's a moving target. Things are always changing. They're always, what was good a year or two ago isn't good enough now. Okay, and so the standards change. And so this is one way that they expect you to keep up with what the latest standards are. So we're going to talk about why GMP, and I'm going to go into a little bit more detail to that, but the basic idea of that is that if you believe, and I think I'm going to give you some pretty good reasons to do that, that controlling a process means that you'll have more predictable outcomes. All right? And if you start thinking about the alternatives, think about making billions of nanoparticles. You're not going to test every one of them, even if you did it non-destructively. And how many things do you have to test to have any statistical significance at all? And it turns out that is why we actually do GMP when we're actually making things for drugs for human use and things like that, because it is impossible to statistically examine things at a level where it's going to be have any meaning whatsoever. So if you control the process, we do get more predictable outcomes, and that's why you'll see that a good deal of the obsession is not only doing the same thing over and over in the laboratory, but literally writing things down. And if you think that your advisors are sticklers for having you write down your procedures in your notebook, you haven't seen anything yet. These people are very serious, because every last little detail can matter. And I've had students in my lab going through where we outlined a procedure, and then they spent 3 months getting totally negative results, and we couldn't figure out why in the world they were not able to do this procedure. So then we sat down and we watched them do it. And there were a few critical steps, like the way that you stirred something, how long you stirred something, how long you waited between steps. All of those things turn out, in some cases, to matter a lot, you know, between something working out very well and not working at all. And those of you who have ever tried building on the work of somebody else, you'll find that that's very, very poorly documented in scientific papers. That's the stuff that the editors make the authors take out because it takes too many pages. All right. And that's why we try to make you put those in to your thesis, because that's probably the only time that it's ever going to get written down thoroughly enough, and to actually make a procedure that somebody else, some person can follow. And as we always say in our lab, there's always that an exercise left to the next student. Well, you might be the next student that has to pick up a project from somebody else, and you'll come to appreciate when they don't give you all of the details. So with regard to GMP, the details are voluminous. And that's so that anybody, anywhere in the world, can actually reproducibly do that manufacture. And we know how hard it is to do, even in the same lab, when a person changes, and then to actually move it from one lab to another lab can be a horrendous exercise. So that's why we're doing this, and why we get really compulsive about what we write down. We're going to talk a little bit about, because we're talking about nanomaterials and things like that, what can be learned from the semiconductor industry and clean room manufacture, because believe it or not, the computer industry probably manufactures things with greater reproducibility than just about any other manufacturing process. And that didn't happen by accident, and it took them a lot of years to be able to do that. And that's why everybody doesn't go out and create the latest Intel chips, okay, in their computer chips in their basement, because it takes a lot to do that and a lot of reproducibility. And then we'll talk a little bit about what doesn't fit in that paradigm. Okay, so this is mainly I've covered this, but this term is something that is used worldwide. It is not just an American expression. It's used everywhere else in the world. And the current state of the art can change, and you're responsible for keeping up for what the current state of the art is. If your procedures are 5 years old and are way behind what the standard is, you can be, if you're trying to manufacture something, you can be shut down. Now, one of the things that's interesting that's happening is that every country is putting up some barriers to, based on largely on GMP or CGMP, where they don't like to take drugs in from other countries. And we see that even in this country, where, you know, we don't like to have drugs from Canada or Mexico or from some other part of the world, because we're not sure what they're doing. Because in many cases, particularly in some countries, the practices are not very reproducible, and we're very concerned about that process. That is going to happen more and more. Europe and the United States are doing that. China and India are next. And the Chinese are starting to, in their own country, trying to worry about these processes, because they can get flooded with things from other countries. So everybody has to worry about this. It's everybody's problem. Not going to go through all of this, but this is a, and I even just grabbed this from Wikipedia. That's not my normal source here. But if you start looking, there's actually some pretty decent write-ups. Wikipedia, as you know, varies in quality, and you got to always be a little careful with it. But I think this write-up was reasonably good, so I used it. So a couple of things, just wanted to go over. One is the sampling, products. And you think about sampling. Most sampling, when you examine things, it's a destructive sampling, meaning that you examine it, but you can't use that thing. You have to throw it away. So destructive sampling, you can't, by definition, is on a subset. Otherwise, you'd have nothing left at the other end to sell. So sampling in general is a lot of it's destructive. If it's non-destructive sampling, then you've got to ask yourself, you know, do I want to examine every single, in this case, nanoparticle? All right, that may or may not be a reasonable thing to do, particularly if you're producing these things in the many billions. So that's something there. And then if you think about how good does it have to be? How good is good enough such that you don't have bad things happen with the manufacturing process? If you produce something that has a few defects in it and it doesn't cause big problems, then you can tolerate that. But if you have things for which a very small number of defective products can lead to a very, very large effect, then you've got a real problem. And therefore, that is, again, one of the reasons why we do the GMP, is because we think it's not realistic to attempt to examine every product, and you cannot sample enough as a subset to be reliable. So if you watch the processes very careful, and then, of course, people do take partial testing of a lot, and they typically do it, and they manufacture as a lot under some circumstances on a particular day. There'll be a lot number that is very carefully written down, because if something happens later on that they discover something's bad with that lot, they can track down, because now with modern logistics, you can follow the paths of all of the things that you've manufactured, and you can pull it basically back if it's subsequently proved wrong. So that's another thing that they do, is say when and where was something manufactured, because that's going to be probably the sources of greatest variation. And as I said, sometimes we recall from the market. We do that in the U.S. all too often, where something doesn't meet the required, and it wasn't found out until it got out in the market and caused usually a bad patient interaction, and we discovered that that lot wasn't manufactured properly, so we have to pull the whole lot before somebody else. And remember, you know that what you're always going to do is you're going to see the most sensitive patients to that defect are going to come up. Maybe many people, maybe 95 out of 100 people might have no reaction to that defect. But those ones that are very sensitive, and that therefore it may take a while to find them, those are the people that are going to flag that there's something wrong with that. And we use the word contaminated means that we have, you know, in any manufacturing process, there's some contamination. And there's some interesting discussions about that with regard to, for example, gold nanoparticles as opposed to gold that's used on orthopedic implants. And as it turns out, that when you start manufacturing things, or actually, I'm sorry, not gold, titanium, as it turns out that when you have something very large and you manufacture it, there will always be contaminants in there. But if you make things at the nanoscale atom by atom, then the contamination should be a lot less. So there's a difference. So sometimes there will be heavy metal leaching from things that are used in bone grafts and things like that are done, that are problems. And we can be a little bit more careful and do things, again, atom by atom, so that we're not doing batch processing in manufacturing nano medical systems. Okay, and again, emphasizing that the World Health Organization has their own versions which kind of transcend across countries. The European and American ones pretty much have set the standard for the WHO. But the idea of that, and there are some variations, the European Union GMP is a little different than the American version of that. And you do have very much well-developed ones in Australia, Canada, Japan, and Singapore, and of course the UK. So there's a lot of variations, but in most cases what we want to do is not vary too much because we want our products to be accepted elsewhere. If we make them in this country, we want to sell them to Europe, we want to sell them to Australia, other parts of the world, and we're going to have to satisfy their standards. So one of the reasons is to make this kind of like an ISO standard that we have in engineering. It's an equivalent for that in terms of the GMP and the World Health Organization version of that, to try to standardize those so we can sell products across, because not everybody sells all products. So I'm going to give you a PDF version of this in terms of the World Health Guide to Good Manufacturing Practice. And there's actually a part one, sort of standard operating procedures, or SOP, and that's something that everybody does in a company, and particularly in a manufacturing. There is a SOP is a standard operating procedure written in very great detail that you use over and over again, and that has to be, an SOP is one of the critical documents in a GMP manufacturing process. Those have to be followed absolutely step by step. They have to be documented and available at any time to inspectors. So that's one of them. The first part one, and then there's a part two, is to how do you validate that? How do you know you did what you thought you did? So as we've said many times in this course, we may do something to make our nanomedical device, and then the question is, did we actually do it? Is that conjugation bond really there? Did we really add that layer? How do we know that? And if we didn't add the layer, how do we know the difference? And this is something I would submit to you that we really probably don't quite know how to manufacture, bio-nano manufacture yet. We know some of the variables, but part of it is almost anything, a process is not perfect. So what you have to do is to be able to separate the defects from the ones that are manufactured. And we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes, about some possibilities for how you might actually do that. Now, no rules are worth anything if there's no enforcement. All right, otherwise we're wasting our time. So the GMP rules are enforced in the United States by the Food and Drug Association, the FDA. And interestingly, in China, it's by the SFDA, okay, for the state FDA, for example. Different ones, for example, in India, there are slightly different ways of doing this. But there are regulatory agencies responsible for looking out for certain things, and they're given that responsibility by their governments. Now, let's think a little bit about, because we're doing nano and bio-nano and bio-nano manufacturing, are the things that we can learn from the clean room. As I mentioned to you, computer chip technology, has had precise manufacturing of millions of copies of things down for a long time. There's a lot of, it's not only millions of copies of a particular computer chip, but remember that there are millions of transistors on each of those chips. So to try to do something with a very, very low defect rate, you know, how do you do that? And a lot of that is done in the processing. They have to follow very precise procedures. And it's interesting, when we set up the Burke Nanotechnology Center, we actually brought a lot of people from industry, because we had to have people who had experience in running clean rooms to be able to do things consistently from day to day. So the first thing is obviously clean air, because there's a lot of things in an air process that normally from sort of macro manufacturing we don't worry about. But when we're talking about doing things on the nanoscale, just the contaminants in the air can be huge. And we have actually measured some of those, not always Some of those were by surprise, where we actually found that we had nitrogen and oxygen bonds that from the air that we had not planned on, that had interacted with our nanomaterials to actually form some additional bonding arrangements. And water, I mentioned to you that what most people consider adequate water is really not adequate, particularly if you're making nanoparticles on the scale of as small or smaller than a virus, then you have to have things that you can remove all the particulates down to probably under 10 nanometers in size. What you get from your drinking fountain outside here has boulders in it. Okay, they're huge. You would be incredibly surprised. They're not unsafe, but your body takes those in. But for a manufacturing process, we would destroy what we're trying to make if we used regular water. And including, remember, all of the ions, because remember, whatever we put those in is going to change things like zeta potentials. It's going to change a lot of things. So we have to be very careful. So clean air and water, I would say we can learn a lot from the semiconductor industry. And we do a lot of the things learned on that basis over in Burke. We have very good air quality and very ultra-pure water. In fact, the water is so pure that if you drink more than a small portion of it, it can kill you, actually. If you know the effect of marathon runners drinking too much water. And it actually can basically bring down their blood concentration and their salt concentration, cause cardiac arrhythmia and arrest. The water that they drink still has a lot of ions in it, but the water that we have over in Burke is so clean that it does that process much faster and more. It would be a much bigger problem. So don't drink too much of that pure water over in Burke. It's made for, again, semiconductor type things and for bio-nano applications. The part that nobody's considered and that we're trying to have some first tries at it, we have a corner of the clean room over in Burke set up as a bio-nano clean room. Its air supply is actually kept separate because we're not quite sure we can do this quite right. And there's pass-throughs so we can make implantable devices and nanoparticles and things that can go from the normal clean room environment put through a portal into the bio-nano clean room, which also then has biologicals that are added. In other words, we can have living organisms, we can have cells, we can have viruses, we can have all kinds of things as part of that. When you start mixing those, if those ever went out and got into the clean room, we would be in big trouble because as you know, in a clean room environment, you have huge exchanges of air. So anything that you put into that environment goes everywhere. And if you put a biological and anything goes everywhere, and that biological is able to reproduce, that would have some pretty frightening consequences. That's the way to destroy a clean room facility, is to have biologicals capable of growth, getting up in the vents and the filters and growing. That would be really bad. So we've isolated that portion. And are trying to learn to deal with this and say, you know, can we get the right mix of clean air, water, interacting with biologicals in a way that we can do something for bio-nano manufacturing. So this is a, I would say, an unresolved question. These are photos from the Burke Nanotechnology Center. And the question is, when you mix the biologicals in here, and particularly things that might be capable of interacting with cells, then you've got a whole bunch of other issues. Okay, so let's talk about cGMP level manufacturing. The first ultimate principle, the major reason why we do this, and the take-home message that I absolutely want you to get, is that predictable methods lead to predictable results. We have to have some faith in that process, because that's the only thing that is guiding really our efforts on this. We have a code of federal regulations, which I'll give you a copy of. Again, it's good for late night reading if you're having trouble sleeping, but you want to know where it is and be able to look at that. and get an idea of what they're doing. So I urge you to just glance through it and look at what's there and see what's covered under it. And then something that, again, most of you are, well, certainly while you're graduate students, are probably not going to be involved in CGMP, but some of you quite well could be involved with GLP, which is a little predecessor stage to GMP. It's good laboratory practices, and that's going to be really important. It is important in some parts of Purdue. Okay, so again, emphasizing the statistical nature of this. If you actually go through the statistics, you can quickly prove to yourself that it is very difficult to impossible for most processes to statistically sample a subset and have it be meaningful in predicting. Remember, you're predicting what's happening in the subset that you didn't sample. So how do you know that? You know, typically what we want to do is have some level. We'll never be 100%. And statistically, what you typically will do is have a 95% confidence limit that you can predict what is happening in the rest of the batch. We're always doing that. Every time you estimate, like the frequency of a tumor cell in blood, what you're doing is you're trying to get a tumor load, for example, on a patient with 95% confidence limits. Well, to do that, it turns out, is very challenging. And we've been involved in a project like that recently, where they're trying to estimate circulating tumor loads in a patient. And then to do that at the levels of like one cell in a million frequencies, you have to sample a lot of blood before you can come out anything close to being a 95% confidence limit. So you need to go through the calculations and prove some of this to yourself. But for example, if you have a presence of one tumor cell, in an average of detection of one tumor cell in a, milliliter of blood, human blood, then to have 95% confidence limits of finding one in a milliliter, you'd have to sample almost 3 mils of blood to have a 95% confidence that you're actually detecting at that level. And that quickly grows up, and then pretty soon you've got an awful lot of blood that you're sampling. So that's just an example of what happens when you actually do the statistical analysis of this. If the method is very reproducible, then you will come out hopefully with an idea that process control will beat your best statistics, that you'll end up with a higher probability for knowing what the entire lot is like than if you actually went in there and tried to sample all of it. And people will, now that doesn't happen by accident. People work very hard to get that level of reproducibility. Most of you will never have to do that in your thesis and your graduate career. But then afterwards, when you get a job in the real world out there, then they will, be asking you to do these kinds of things and to develop procedures that are that predictable. One of the things you'll hear people moaning and groaning, both at good laboratory practice and particularly if they're preparing things for FDA, is the documentation is immense. And that's the biggest thing, because to guarantee the process, you're writing everything down. The best procedure you've ever written is probably not up to the standards that would be expected on here. And knowing the variability. I'm famous for breaking in new students with going in and looking at one of their procedures and putting my finger on one line in the procedure, and I'll say, that looks interesting. That looks like a 5-hour process. Can you take a bathroom break in there? Okay. Well, most human beings aren't going to last 5 hours before they, unless they have, they're like fighter jets or astronauts and they have special tubing linked up to them. So you need to know, when is a step time critical? That's what I'm really asking. When does it matter whether it's 10 minutes or 12 minutes or 20 minutes? Does it make a difference? And all of that, that's the kind of thing that you, when you're working this out and the documentation, you have to know what is your bound. How critical time critical is your process. You're always measuring things, and you're assuming that what you're measuring, that you can measure it faster than it's changing. It would be a very, you know, that may sound like a funny thing to say, but you would be surprised at how people try to measure things that are changing in minutes, and they're sitting there taking minutes to do the measurements. It happens all the time. So you need to find out how stable is your actual process you're measuring, what kind of time period do you have, and how good is that time period? Time is really important for a lot of these measurements. And how accurate does the measurement have to be? Does it have to be good enough to be able to show reproducibility? Doing something to four significant digits doesn't mean much if doing it to two significant digits is all that's going to be used to predict the performance of something. So you need to know all this and try to figure out what is reasonable. So here's an example of what the code of regulations actually looks like. Giving you the URL, you can go in there and spend many hours that I don't have, and you probably don't have either right now to do that. But let's abstract that a little bit and come back. And I've told you to look. If you look anywhere, look in parts 210 and 211 of the Code of Federal Regulations. These are the provisions that they're going to worry about, including who's doing it and what's the training of that person. Because if a person is not well trained, you know very well that in the laboratory somebody can make something work and the next person comes along and they can't make it work at all. Okay? And so there's a function not only of procedures but training and understanding. What you're hoping to do is with really good procedures written down to be able to minimize the variation from personnel. Okay, but I can tell you I've done experiments with that, particularly ones involving judgment, like looking through a microscope and making a judgment call and finding out that some people are highly reproducible, but not necessarily accurate. Other people are always very accurate, meaning they get the right result, but they have a lot of variation in the way that they come up with their results. So that's very important. How you set things up can make a huge difference. I had once 6 months worth of experiments that would not replicate. And we were trying for 6 months to reproduce something looking at virus cell interactions. It turned out that somebody had decided to clean the distilled water lines, okay, with a chemical, which was then leaching out in parts per million and changing all of the results. So we got nothing reproducible for 6 months. Because, again, of buildings and facilities and equipment. That was really hard to track down because we kept doing our procedures exactly the same, and yet we were using a distilled water source that had changed and we didn't know it. Control of all of the components and products and things, even when you move things around. For example, on the nano level, we had experiments one time where we were taking the measurement in the laboratory, we got one result. We had another totally different result when we actually did the experiment, formulated experiment across campus and then carried it in a container across and brought it to the facility. Now, who would have thought that? But it turned out that at the nano level, things leach out of containers. All right? And that's what it was. It was actually things leaching out of what you would think is a very stable container. Was changing all the zeta values, zeta potential values. Obviously, things like packaging and distribution, this is the logistics side, so that when you ship it out the door, you know you've labeled it, what the lot number is, the conditions and so on, and so you know where it went so that if you have to go find it again and pull it back, and that's going to be really important for any kind of distribution for any kind of human use. And then, obviously, you'll be swimming in records and controls. That's why I prefer to do basic research rather than manufacturing research. But somebody has to do this. Otherwise, all the things that we do in research will not come to have any good meaning. Okay, good laboratory practices. I just want to bring up one thing here of importance. Obviously, this is important to manufacturing processes, but sometimes we have this thing that once you start a process of submitting data to the FDA if the data are bad, you can't just get rid of it and say, oh, that's a bad experiment and throw it away. It all gets included in there. So that's the bad side. So sometimes people want to wait a while before and get things worked out well, and then they have their starting point. Okay, all the data from here on are part of what I'm going to submit to the FDA. But with good laboratory practice, what people are finding, particularly when they do experiments back at animal level, they may find that they want to actually submit that also to the FDA to accelerate the testing that goes on in humans. And so what they'll do is they'll quite often use the GLP data as early data that was important. And the good thing about this is you don't have to use it, but you can. So if you're still, you know, there's always this point, how do you know when you've got a process down well enough that it's reproducible day to day? You may think you have it and then you don't. Some other variable comes in that you hadn't thought about. But if things are going well, you can go back to that, provided you've been doing it under GLP conditions, you can go back to that and include it into the data that you send to the FDA, and they will take that into account. So it's kind of like, it costs you a little bit to do GLP. It's not as bad as full GMP level or CGMP, but it has some advantages that at some point you can actually use this data and not have to start from scratch. So here's a little bit more. I won't go through this slide, but it's got a bunch of things. It's a system of management and control of controlling the entire process, all the variables that I showed you. So let's talk a little bit about what's special about the manufacturing. First of all, biomanufacturing, we're already learning a lot of things. As I said, mentioned to you a little earlier about, we've been talking about the monoclonal antibodies that we have against, cancers. Some of the early ones, like rituximab, was patented in 1997. It's going to be one of the very first ones that's going to run out as a patent. And so, people are starting to gear up, and particularly I know that there are some generic manufacturing efforts going on in India for biologicals coming out of there. Biologicals are a whole lot harder to produce than chemistry. So if we have a small drug, we have a chemical process, it's well thought out. The biggest thing is that the chemical processes are more reproducible, they're more self-contained. And one of the things that we have in a biological is a lot of the biologicals at some point are not a completely closed system coming from the same things, and it makes it a lot harder for that reason. So biomanufacturing is inherently a little bit harder if it's using organisms. Particularly if you're making monoclonal antibodies, for example, you're typically at some point you're putting that into a mouse and you're making a myeloma, and and that there will be variability in that process. So that's already showing us that we have some issues there. And because of that, if you can think about then if you're using antibodies as targeting mechanisms on your nanoparticles, you're going to have all of the things that we've already learned about manufacturing antibodies, for example, for anti-cancer therapy, plus all of the other things. Nano clean water, as we mentioned, is a necessity. It's beyond what people worry about the chemical constituents, but at some point, actual particulates itself can be a problem. Contaminants can be at very, very low levels. We know that when you make some system that has biologicals, depending on what it is, a few parts per million background contaminants can change everything. So you really have to measure that. So now you have both size and organics, and those things can interact. And the one that I really want to caution, and this is something that we're just starting to get into, is can you scale up the process? And if you've ever heard Professor Kanam Park talk about this, he's constantly, this is one that he is very big on, is saying, because he's tried to do some serious scale-up with both in his laboratory and in his spin-off company. quite often, when you want to go from taking very small amounts from doing an in vitro experiments, let's say you're doing in vitro screening of cell types, and then the next step you might go to a nude mouse or a mouse experiment, and then you want to go from a mouse up to maybe a dog, and that's what we're trying to do right now in some collaborations with Debbie Knapp for dog bladder cancer, where the dog is a better model for human bladder cancer than a mouse is. It turns out that we're talking a huge scale-up, you know, hundreds of times scale-up of the process of making all of the nano drug delivery systems that we're making. And things which work well in small quantities sometimes don't work so well in very large, and doing scale-ups is very challenging. So can you scale up the process and not have to do some change which may fundamentally, remember, particularly for nano things, we're doing self-assembly, which has to be done thermodynamically under some pretty strict conditions, and you're doing atom by atom. When you start having very large volumes and then controlling things like temperature, thermodynamically driven processes becomes harder. So scale up, I'm thinking, is probably going to be one of the big processes. Now, we've had this, and this slide before, I've just made a very slight change in it. For testing instrumentation and techniques, there's a lot of things in this slide, but I'm going to call your attention first to what's in yellow. For nanoparticle fabrication, we know that we have particularly things like dynamic light scattering, zeta potential, atomic force microscopy, TEM, other things where we can characterize the particles in various ways. And that allows us to focus in on the particle. But remember, the thing that we've got here is we've got a system that you're not just making the nanoparticle, you're making the particle and then trying to have it have a predictable interaction with a cell. So you may think that you've got it exactly right over by testing all the things in yellow, but if you don't take it over and look at nanoparticle cell interactions, there may be something that is too subtle for you to measure in the actual nanoparticle characterization. And that particularly that's true for targeting, because you never know what the targeting is unless you actually test it. You may think that that molecule, let's say that that particular targeting molecule is exactly the same as what you had before, but there may be some subtle changes in it. So that's why we've done a lot of things looking at nanoparticle cell interactions. That's the other key in all of this. So you need to think about those, and if you can't measure it, then you don't really know what you have. So we always want to try to have things which are measurable. So finishing that, just sort of putting it all together again for you, some quality control issues. We can talk all we want about having a reproducible process, but to get to a reproducible process in the first place, we have to worry about these variables. Correctness of the size, we have to get, as you know, I've sort of taught you that that word of the so-called Goldilocks principle of it not being too hot or too cold, but just right, as in the bowl of porridge. And here, with regard to nanotechnology, we have that the size has to be right. It says not too small, not too large. It has to be just right. There is a correctness of size, because the same nanoparticles can behave very differently. Same material can behave very differently, both themselves and also their interaction with cells based on their size. Composition, we have to do atomic level. We're doing atomic level and layer by layer assembly, so we have to be able to actually look at those at that level. We've talked a little bit about that with X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy when you're working out the basics, but obviously you're not going to do XPS analysis as a standard thing often on as a method of testing. Monodispersity versus agglomeration. We've talked about that in regard to things like using dynamic light scattering and so-called zeta sizing, where you can actually pick up the how you can actually get measures, and that's a very complicated calculation that's done with the data, and I'm not going to go into that but in the class here, but I'll be happy to discuss it with you if that's an issue. But they will come out with a polydispersity index to say how monodisperse or polydisperse, being where you may have different subpopulations, various degrees of agglomeration. These are big issues when you make things, because when things agglomerate, they have different properties. Order and correctness of layers. You know, we've been talking about throughout the course about how you design a nanomedical system. Now, if you actually made this, how would you test? And how would you know what fraction of the particles that you made actually had every layer in the right order? Remember, if you're going to control a sequence of events and make a programmable nanoparticle by layer assembly, then you have to know that that layer was on there. Because what you'll find in practice when you do it in the lab, there will be a subset, hopefully a small subset, of particles which may have missed making the layer for one reason or not. And if they missed making the layer, they can effectively skip that step of the multi-layered process. That may be important, very important, or it may not have very high consequences. But you have to know that. The correctness of the zeta potentials. And I've urged you to check the zeta potential at every stage. I think what you're going to find is when people do cGMP with nanodrug delivery systems, probably the zeta potential, and particularly if there's subcomponents of it, the zeta potential is going to be a very important thing, and that's and partly because it can be measured. And does the nanomedical system contain the correct payload? We know that getting drugs into nanosystems, even in liposomes, that there's only a certain amount of drug uptake, and it's not always a very efficient process, and there's variation. So that means that you may have considerable variation in the amount of drug per nanoparticle because of that, the way that many of those things are actually taking in the drug. And lastly, targeting and mistargeting, specificity and sensitivity. Always when you talk about targeting, you have a question of specificity. Does it hit the right cells? And then do you have enough concentration of things for long enough, including circulation time, that you actually have the sensitivity to actually get a very high percentage of the cells you're trying to target? Otherwise, you're going to get a subset of them. And you have to know how good is good enough in terms of having enough particles of enough sensitivity and specificity. So with that, I'll be happy to, I'm going to give you these things in PDF or hyperlinks so that you can go, if you're interested, look up further things.